I think what we're looking for more than anything is just to be less alone in our struggles. And I think it's very rarely the struggle itself that we're dealing with. It's the feeling of being alone in that struggle, that nobody knows what I'm going through. Nobody knows how to help me. People are going to reject me if they really know and understand. And I think that sometimes nothing in our life can change, nothing about our challenges, our struggles, our mental health, our emotional health, our relationship crises, or whatever it might be, or moral failings, or whatever is going on. I think that when we know that we're not alone, like somebody sees us, and I think that that's what we're yearning for more than anything. And so I think the legacy that I want and hope to leave behind is that people feel less alone in their journey.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of For Soul's Sake with Radhika Das, and today another special guest, but in a special location. This is our first podcast that we're taking over the seas, over towards New York, and I'm just so excited to speak with this person, to listen, learn, and grow with each and every one of you. Today we are joined by the amazing, the spectacular, the personal, one of the people that I really looked up to in the world of leadership, management, in the world of being visionaries, but for spiritual cause. His name is Dayal Gauranga. He's been on a spiritual journey his entire life, seeking truth from a really young age. At 18 years old, really young, 18 years old, he became a monk and dedicated himself to a life of spiritual study, reflection, and service. Having lived in ashrams across the United States, he made his way to New York City in 2008 to participate in the formative years of the beautiful place that is known as the Bhakti Center. After 10 years of monastic life, he transitioned out of monkhood in 2013, meeting his wife, and is now married, continuing to live and serve in New York City as the executive director of the Bhakti Center, a nonprofit spiritual and cultural center in Manhattan. In 2017, Dayal completed his 200-hour yoga teacher certification from Super Soul Academy and holds a degree in clinical psychology from Hunter College. Dayal, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for being here. I feel like I need to just reciprocate the amazing introduction. Oh. I feel a little overwhelmed and just grateful. Everything back at you times 10. And thank you for just giving the platform to just share and be here. It's really, really an honor for me. Thank you.
It's amazing for me that there's so many people who are living diverse, broad, different types of lifestyles, but still centered in deep spirituality. And that was what I wanted to bring the audience. That's what I wanted to bring out in this podcast, to bring about holistic, open conversation, candid conversation about spirituality with broad varieties of people from across the world. So this is our first international episode, and I want to thank you so much for being the first guest.
Wow, I'm the first international episode.
First international, yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for having the podcast. I think that it's something that we overlook sometimes, that we sometimes think of, you know, you think of podcasts and you think of like amazing people that get interviewed, and there's a lot of really amazing people out there, but the reality is that so many people have amazing stories in their lives and amazing insights. And I think that's one of the things that you start to learn a little bit about the more that you engage with people, and you meet so many people around the world. You're doing kirtans, you're doing retreats, and you're visiting here in New York, you have some programs here, and the more people that you meet, it's like, wow, everyone is an amazing person, and everybody has a tremendous story to tell and insights that they glean from it. And so thank you for creating this podcast for people like me and others to kind of share and connect with the world. So thank you. I really, really appreciate you a lot. And everything you're doing for the world and sharing and kirtan and podcasts, doing amazing stuff.
Trying to make my place in the world one of light and love. So thank you so much for being so kind to me and welcoming here. I want to get stuck in, Dayal. You're the director... executive director, let me get the title right, executive director at the Bhakti Center, a non-for-profit spiritual and cultural center in Manhattan. Manhattan's a wild place. Does it feel a little out of place to have a spiritual center in such a busy, commercial, capitalist center of the world?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, for all the reasons that you just mentioned, especially, I mean, like, dial it back a little bit. I've been in New York for 15 years. Which is interesting because I've been in New York for more of my adult life than I have in California, which is where I'm from. Mm. I moved to New York when I was 23. I'm now 38. And so I've been adult in New York mostly. It's been my home for the most part. And I lived as a monk here in New York for 5 years. And at that time, you know, that question would come up even more so. Is like, what are you doing as a monk in New York City? What is there? There's an ashram or there's a monastery. Like, why would you move here? And I used to live in Laguna Beach, which is a much more tranquil place. It's a little coastal city. It's really beautiful. And you know, to move here, and like, why would you do that? And I think that I just recall that oftentimes, usually where there's the greatest need, there's the greatest opportunity to serve. And I think that we live in a society today where, you know, for me, my spiritual values, when the places that I generate spiritual wisdom from, is from people and places that move towards the messes, mm-hmm. move towards the places where there's need. And I think that that was also something that I realized when I was transitioning out of monkhood, because part of it was like, okay, I'm living in New York City. I want to continue doing what I'm doing in service. Is the lifestyle that I'm living conducive for that? And so I made a transition out of monkhood to just get married. I met a beautiful woman who's now my wife. We started a family. We have a dog now, 3 years old.
Beautiful.
I shared a meme the other day where somebody was asking the question, did you adopt your dog? And the answer was no, he's our biological dog. And so that's our little family. But, you know, and it was one of the things that, you know, sometimes people do when they get married, they look at astrology charts or they get counseling or different things like that. And one something that somebody told me, they were looking like in my life and at my chart and in my just kind of like my personality. And they were saying that your nature will be to run away from difficult relationships. And it's part of something I've recognized in me off the bat. Like, I'm a Scorpio. I've got Pitta. I've got like all of the signs of like intensity in my life. And it's really easy for me to dive deep into a relationship. And it's really easy for me to cut something off when it's not working. And when I look all the way back, you know, you were asking before the podcast, like, is there anything off topic for this? And I was like, you want to get into my childhood trauma? And so I was just thinking, like, well, when you do go back and look at like my childhood and my, I was talking with my sister a little while ago about what, you know, the ways in which I grow up and when things get difficult, whether it's my parents or my family or my stepdad or whatever it might be, it's easy for me just to kind of close off and cut down. And they were saying that also in your marriage, you got to be careful for that, because it's easy for you to just, as soon as something gets difficult, you just kind of like retreat. And whether that's in a marriage and relationship, whether that's in a company or a business, whether it's in friendship, I just recognize that actually, like, we grow so much by working through the messes that life presents us.
Wow.
And so I think that in a place like New York City, where you think it's the least conducive place for spirituality, you know, as an individual, you would think like, yeah, just remain as a monk or just stay away from everything material. But actually, it's like it's in a close, intimate relationship with another person. I've been able to see things about myself that I never saw in 10 years of living in an ashram or monastery. Is living in New York City, you start to come up against parts of your own ego and resistance, and you're forced to flex a compassion muscle that maybe never would have gotten flexed if you're just living in a cave or just kind of meditating in a forest or just kind of staying outside the messiness of what's going on in the world. So in a lot of ways, New York City is the perfect place for a spiritual center and to try to practice spiritual life and to serve and to engage with all that stuff. So,
did you find it hard being here as a monk?
No, I didn't. To be honest with you, I enjoyed in some ways my time being as a monk. And I think that, you know, the word, we use this word ashram, you know, sometimes, you went and stayed in an ashram. But the word ashram literally means a place of shelter. And so I took a lot of shelter in the space that we have where we lived, the brotherhood of monks that I stayed with. And so I felt like we went out into the world and we did our services. I did a lot of outreach and community projects in universities at NYU and Columbia University. One of the monks in our ashram was a chaplain at both schools. And so we did a lot of just work, meditation sessions, vegetarian cooking classes, discussion groups. But then it was always kind of, you'd have your home base, and we had our solid every morning. We had our like kind of prayer and meditation and study. And then we had our meals that we shared together. We went to bed early. So you kind of had a cutoff point in the day. So I actually found it, I liked it.
Do you recommend it for everyone? Is it something that, you
know? No, 100% not. I don't think there's anybody you can recommend for anybody necessarily. I think
that's
that
deep, because I think a lot of people say the opposite, right? Like everyone, I mean, all the monks that I've ever met or previous monks have always said, yeah, it's a period I think that I highly recommend. So I'm interested why you think it's not for everyone.
Because I think, you know, everybody has their particular, I mean, what's spoken in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, ancient spiritual text of wisdom. One of two verses that's spoken twice. It's better to live your life, even imperfectly, than to try to copy somebody else's.
Perfectly, yeah.
And so the externalities of life are going to look differently for everybody. The point is that how am I growing towards love and service and more towards myself? And it may be that there's a period of monastic life that somebody needs to have, but I think that the principles that you're trying to get out of that monastic life can be achieved in a variety of different ways. I do think that there is a time of life where we should go through some basic spiritual training, and that might be by moving into an ashram or a monastery, or it might just be, you know, you might be single, just living outside, and outside meaning outside of an ashram on your own somewhere. But I think there's different ways of going about it. I don't think you have to move, because some people may move in and just drive them crazy.
Right.
And you're just going to become more just like tweaked out, and mm-hmm. it's not going to necessarily be healthy for you. I think you have to be really honest about what works for you.
What kind of nature do you think then, say for example, you're listening to this podcast, and just the word monk is super attractive. It is for so many people.
Sure.
We can get into that, why you think monkhood is so attractive to the masses. But what kind of person do you think can really spend, you know, like, I know some monks have done it for their whole lives, like 40 years plus.
Yeah.
So
I did it for 10.
Yeah. I mean, what natures of kinds of people do you think would be really conducive to that situation of living?
Yeah. Well, I'll dial it back just a second. I do think that there's value for everybody to take time in their life, especially at a younger age when you have the facility to really create a spiritual foundation for you. You know, that may mean becoming a monk, or that may mean, you know, just getting really involved in a spiritual community in some way. But I think the nature that's required for a monk, the word surrender comes to mind, and the, you know, really letting go of all the stories I have about myself and the way my life is supposed to look. Because you're just kind of like actually, and a good mutual friend of ours, Avira, who a year ago, at the beginning of 2022, I was talking with him about something, and it was like the beginning of the year, and we kind of have this whole sense of like, what's your year going to look like? What's your 2023 going to look like? And this idea that we're just kind of having this blank canvas that we just kind of splay our life out. Like, what are you going to create in your life? As if it's like it's a blank canvas. And he was talking about the idea, like, you know, monkhood is not just retreating from life, but it's coming closer towards my spiritual roots and identifying what is my connection with higher power? What is my connection with God in the heart? And what is my connection with understanding that I'm partnering with some divine higher power about what life's supposed to look like and how I can make my best contribution to the world. And so I think that you really have to let go of this idea that like I'm the main character in the story of my life.
Wow.
And that actually like it's not about me being in the center. Because that's what I'm saying is like if it's about you being in the center, you're gonna go crazy. You're gonna just kind of be you're going to create friction with other people. And so I think the main thing is whether you can have a passionate personality or someone, you know, normally you think like monastic life means I'm like calm and subdued and I'm quiet and I just kind of peaceful and serene. And I don't necessarily think that has to be the case. I think it has to be a willingness to accept that I don't live at the center of everybody's life. And I'm not even at the center of the world, but I'm willing to put something, someone, something higher than myself at the center.
Wow. Everyone wants to be at the back of the bus, at the front of Bhakti Center on a Thursday night in Kirtan, and in the center of attention at all times. And I think that we live a life where so much of it is about me, my well-being, and that has its time and place, of course. But I think that there is so much to be said about moving yourself away from being self-absorbed all the time. And it's so healthy to kind of just see what is it that I can do to serve others. How can I place myself not in the center, but put divinity in the center, God in the center, you know, a higher community in the center.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks volumes for people's character.
Yeah.
You know, when someone mentions that they're doing something, even if it's just philanthropic, nothing to do with divinity, nothing spiritual per se, but just philanthropy and just helping people on the level of humanitarian aid, I think that has so much to speak in volumes of that person's character. And I want to kind of go into your role now at the Bhakti Center, which is, if you've never been to the Bhakti Center, people, you need to get on a flight, no matter where you are in the world and listen to this, get on a flight and come to the Bhakti Center. It's a phenomenal spiritual oasis. And I just genuinely, I went this morning before I came here, and it's like stepping into a spiritual world. Let's put it plainly, a spiritual world. And Dayal and an amazing team have come together there to really create and curate a space which is welcoming for anyone no matter who they are, to walk in and experience bhakti yoga, experience Vedic spirituality, and it's phenomenal. But there's one thing that I've always wondered. You're a manager, you're someone that is a leader, and for me, every time I've been in a leadership position, and maybe it's my nature speaking here, I've always found it hard to be spiritual, because there's some tough calls that have to be made sometimes. You know, I can appreciate, maybe we can even get into some of those decisions, but there are tough calls you have to make as a manager, as a leader, as an executive director of such a space. Does that feel antagonizing to your spiritual values? Honestly, candidly.
I think it's a great question, and I'll start with this, with the story that someone was just sharing with me, a real life story. I won't mention names, but there was a spiritual leader whom we both know and revere, and who several years ago was on a phone conversation, and they were staying at somebody's house, and they had the phone, and they were holding the phone like on speaker, so they were just talking to the person's speaker, so the other person was able to kind of like listen in a little bit, and the other person on the other end of the phone was just kind of like railing against this person, this spiritual leader, just kind of like criticizing them and just kind of like attacking them, and wow. In a way, and this person was just, they were just taking it, they were just listening and they were just taking it. And then at the end of it, when it just got quiet, the other person on the phone just said that, you know, I've always just noticed that there just seems to be some like angst that you have towards me, like whether it's like envy or anger or whatever, and I just want to let you know that I love you.
Wow.
And the other person just like completely was like arrested. And it's the kind of thing that when it's said with like purity and genuine, like if I said this, it probably would just come across like as phony.
Cheesy.
But it was like this person had such a spiritual depth to them, and like that they actually genuinely meant it. And I've seen in advanced spiritualists over time, it's like people criticize you and it's like they're not taking it personally. They're just taking it like, I don't know if it's something in that person that they are like working through, or maybe there's something genuinely in me that I'm doing to make somebody mad, whatever it is. But what I do know is that I love you.
Wow.
And I care about you. And I want what's best. And I'm willing as a leader, transferring it back to me, like what I try to about, like as a leader, I'm not always going to have the best solutions. I'm not always going to make the best decisions. I don't always know what's right. It's my job to make decisions. It's my job to move things forward. That's part of, because I've lived in and around the Bhakti Center for a number of years, and I've seen various phases of leadership, and at times when there's been a vacuum of leadership, and meaning that, you know, and transitions of leadership. And
what's a vacuum of leadership?
Vacuum of leadership means when there's no leader.
Okay.
Vacuum of leadership, gotcha, meaning gotcha. Like it's in a transition phase,
gotcha.
And they haven't appointed a leader, or there's like group leadership and it's not clear how decisions are made, and things just get stuck. And it's just like you need a leader. You need somebody to like make decisions and move things forward. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a case, you know, one period when COVID first hit and the pandemic, you know, and people shifted, and before appointing, you know, there's a period when our previous leader left and when I was appointed leadership where there was a little bit of a vacuum of like clear point leadership. And so you need someone to make decisions, move things forward. And so it's my job to do that, but I'm not guaranteeing that I'm always going to get it right. And so I think that as a leader, the way that it becomes spiritual is when you just kind of have to just pull back and remind yourself, like, my number one job is just to love each person that I'm trying to serve.
Wow.
And remind yourself of that, and remind people of that, and be open to feedback, be open to being corrected. One of my spiritual heroes, Vaisheshika Prabhu, he always mentions, you know, I live to be corrected, you know, and it's just like, wow, I live to be corrected. And if there's a better way of doing it, please let me know. But I just, and I don't always get this right. Like I'm speaking from a place like, don't think like I am the ideal leader because I'm talking about this. Like I'm talking about this because it's like something that I remind myself daily, you know, and I'm constantly getting, it's the most humbling thing in the world. I tell people all the time that my job as executive director, half of my job is making apologies and the other half is making all the dumb mistakes that require me to make an apology to other people. Like it's just constant,
I love that.
It's constant embarrassment, humiliation, you know, rubbing people the wrong way, falling on your sword, eating your humble pie. And so I think that if you enter from a my way or the highway, like this is how it's going to be done. And if you enter into like I know what's best, I'm the appointed leader, all follow me. Yeah, put that crown on your head and it's just like, don't you know who I am? It just doesn't work. And I think that the way it becomes spiritual is you recognize that more than anything, and I told myself this when I first moved into this position, is that more than anything, the biggest work being done is on my ego.
Mm.
And no matter where this goes, it's an opportunity for me to like really come in contact with all of the icky stuff in my heart. So I think that it actually becomes an extraordinarily spiritual practice, but it's a hard one and it's a painful one because it forces you to just lay down the burden of your ego and just, but it's beautiful because you get to come to a place where you're unburdened by the exhausting weight of just trying to be better than other people and compete with other people and just be like, I love you.
I love you. I love you.
I love you too, man. I appreciate it a lot. I really mean it. And I love you listening out there.
Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, one of the things that I've had to really had, I mean, it's been a hard lesson for me, I'll be honest. In the last 2 years, in the last year and a half, 2 years, is learning that exact lesson. Mm. That even though my role might be singing mantra into a microphone and facilitating experiences of kirtan, of bhakti, etc., what it really is an opportunity for me to learn that it's all about loving people. Yeah. And it's all about loving God, loving who is a person, loving people who are on the receiving end of that kirtan. And the kirtan, so to speak, doesn't end when the music stops. You know, kirtan means to glorify divinity, to glorify, to praise, to come together to sing and through musical meditation, glorify that which is in one sense unperceivable, divinity, God. But really, the role of someone who's sharing spirituality or even interested in being a spiritualist is not just about preaching, not just about being someone who gives the gospel, but someone who is trying to encourage others to just love. That the whole principle of spirituality, the whole foundation, the bedrock of spirituality is this four-lettered word, love. And do you think that some people will never be able to love in the same capacity? Because what I'm speaking maybe sounds a little bit too lofty. Do you think that some people will always struggle with that four-lettered word?
No, I don't think anybody is destined to always struggle with that. I think we have different times. You know, somebody once asked me if love is something that we learn, and I just came out of my mouth that I don't think love is something we learn. I think it's just something we remember, because we're made of love. We genuinely are. The nature of the soul is that it's eternal, it's cognizant and full of wisdom, and it's joyful. And that joy is created by loving relationships with God and other living beings. And so I think it's you know, like the nature of the sun that's always shining.
Wow.
Like
this,
we're in New York right now. It's cloudy. It's still cold. It's almost May, and we're wondering when it's going to warm up. But it's not, the sun isn't shining any less. It's just covered by clouds. And so I think all of us have a different degree of covering that is blocking the soul from experiencing its genuine loving nature. Because the reality is, I'm not in competition with you.
Mm.
My soul is just genuinely, that's just the genuine nature of the soul. I was just reading, just recently, I've been thinking a lot about like the idea of like misgivings with other people and like forgiveness and the things that get in the way of us actually experiencing genuine love with other
Why?
People.
I just have interest in the context. What's the reason that you're thinking about that more?
Because I'm constantly going through it.
Okay.
Because I'm in a leadership position
because
I'm in a leadership position at the Bhakti Center, and I'm constantly making mistakes and needing to apologize for them. And so, there was just something recently that I was going through an interpersonal thing with somebody, and it was really eating me up and uh-huh. just kind of creating insecurities and doubts. And you fluctuate between, I don't know if you ever had this experience where you fluctuate between like super self-righteous, what do they do? How do they do that to me? To like, it's all my fault and I'm the worst person. And I just want to apologize and make everything right and just let me. And then it's like you go back and forth and everyone in between. So anyways, I've just been thinking a lot about that. And when you're in a spiritual position of leadership, you also think about all the things you talk about every day, you know, and all the things that we preach about and speak about. And it's just like, gosh, like I should be a little bit better than where I am right now. Like I should be. And so I'm just thinking about that. And I've been thinking about misgivings and, mm-hmm. and connecting more deeply with people and forgiveness. And I was looking up this verse in the Bhagavad Gita that was talking about where, because you're talking about like kirtan being to praise or to glorify or to put God in the center.
Mm.
And there was this verse I was talking about that when we put these four things, our intelligence, our mind, our faith, and our refuge, this word of shelter, in the supreme, in a higher person, in that higher power, in something beyond ourselves. And they said that we're able to release all misgivings. And I was thinking like, wow, it's because I'm not putting myself at the center.
Mm.
And because actually I'm recognizing that like, the struggle that I'm having with another person is because they're not playing the supporting role of my life that I want them to play. And recognizing that they're never designed to play the supporting role in the movie of my life, that they're actually meant to develop their own loving relationship with their own higher power in a way, and I'm meant to develop my own loving relationship with a higher power. And from that place of being filled up internally, I'm no longer trying to squeeze something out of you. You know, I'm no longer thinking that like my life's gonna be better once you recognize how great I am or apologize for the way that you offended me. But actually it's like my focus is just in the wrong place. And so I think again, like back into leadership like position, is that when I recognize like my focus isn't try to like, this isn't just part of my ego project to get something from other people, but it's actually a place for me to recognize like, where do I get my fulfillment from? Mm-hmm. Where do I go to nourish my cup and put that my intelligence, my mind, my faith, and my refuge in something higher, so that when I'm interacting with other people, I'm actually interacting from a place of just being able to experience somebody in a different way.
It's interesting that you speak about love in that way, where it's like, you have to, how did you say it? Mind, intelligence?
Faith and refuge.
Faith and refuge. Placing them in something higher than one's own. So say, for example, someone who's listening to this is going through a period of, I don't know what the correct vocab is here, but unlovingness, like they're not feeling A, very loved, and B, very loving towards others. And you spoke about that has a lot to do with their interactions with people, and you can learn a lot about, you know, but it feels so counterintuitive when you're feeling not loved and you're not feeling very loving to be in the association of other people. You almost want to curl into a ball and put yourself away from the world. And so is that also like a valid method of finding love, or do you think it's necessary that we have to be around people?
I think we all have our periods of time where we need to coil into a ball and hide under the bed sheets. I mean, I do those sometimes for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if it wasn't for podcast episodes like this, I wouldn't get out of the house. And so thank you for getting out of the house this morning.
You're welcome.
But I do think we need that. I think it's just important that we don't live there.
We don't live there.
Yeah, wow. We don't live there. Wow. And I think we recognize that we all need our time to ourselves. You all need time to just kind of recoil. And I think it's also important for us to just give us credit for how hard it is to be doing what we're doing. Like we live in a really hard society,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, we don't have a lot of space. Like even if you're crawling under the sheets in your bed, you still got like an entire universe there on your phone or your tablet that's just kind of add to the anxiety that you're experiencing by looking up and seeing all the beautiful things that other people are doing with their life that making you feel like crap about yourself and whatever it might be.
Envy gram,
totally. And so I think that it is important for us, but at the end of the day, we do have to find like, how do I get out of that? How do I move towards being in a better place, I think is an important question. And I think that, because we don't want to stay there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The non-permanence of all emotions, eh? This too shall pass.
And I think I think it's important.
I'm going to try and move towards something slightly, for me, more different and maybe interesting for others as well. Criticism. You mentioned that when, you know, in your role that you're most of the time apologizing, or you're trying. What was the other thing you said? You're either
I'm apologizing or I'm making all the dumb mistakes that make me have to apologize to somebody for it.
I love that. That's so hilarious. But, I mean, it's true though. That's what most.
It's a very simple job description.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like every not even spiritual leader, like prime minister, president of the United States, has to figure out how to manage forgiveness and manage how to apologize without sounding like they're apologizing half the time. Criticism is something that we all have to experience, whether you're a leader or not. You know, there's a story of a person who's walking through a village, I think it's Jerusalem, with a donkey and his son. And this person's walking through the village, and through the first village they go, everyone starts laughing because the son is sitting on the donkey and he's saying, oh, this guy's so foolish, look, he's an old man, da-da-da-da-da. Then the next village they go through, again, everyone criticizes because he is now sitting on the donkey and his son is now walking. Say, look, he's so foolish. He's putting his son on the floor, you know, like young little boy pulling the donkey and the father. And then in the third village, they both get off the donkey and so criticism is part and parcel of life. And two parts question, I guess. One is how to deal with criticism, and B is how to avoid criticizing others.
Yeah. How to deal with criticism and how to avoid criticizing others. Well, I'll start with how to avoid criticizing others. Again, I think it starts with what are you looking for in life? I think that spirituality is a process of recognizing It's not a set of rules that you have to avoid criticizing, otherwise you're a bad person. It's what does criticizing do to my heart? You know, there's things that we eat that we know are bad for us. You were talking about just before, you know, feeling energy because you're getting rid of like snacks and crisps, as you call them across the seas. We call crisps. Them chips. Chips here in America, you know.
Incorrect,
you know. you know, whether you're eating junk food or lots of refined sugars or like whatever else it may be, we know there are things that add cholesterol or add stress to our liver or to our heart or to our kidneys. And at the same time, there are things that add stress to our actual loving heart. And criticism is one of those things. And so I think we avoid criticism by no longer thinking like, well, is it justified or is it right or does it need to be said? As opposed to like, what is this doing to my heart? Like, I'm going to avoid criticism because I don't like the way I feel when I do it. And I've never come across an instance where I felt good after criticizing somebody. I never felt good after pointing out the ways that other people are wrong. I never feel good after a good gossip session.
Maybe for a little while.
For a little while. Just the way you might feel like after you eat some chips or some pancakes for breakfast.
True.
You get a sugar rush.
True.
You know? But it's not lasting.
You ultimately
feel empty afterwards. It's not sustaining calories. You know? It's just junk food for the soul. And so I think that ultimately, you know, you might get like, it's like anger. You might have like a burst of relief after just like letting go the shotgun of your anger, but then there's like all the consequences of it afterwards. And so I think really it's about, you know, if I want to feel love in my heart, I need to find ways to act lovingly. If I want to feel like, somebody once mentioned like the lotus, every time we criticize another person, the lotus flower of our heart contracts. And so it's just like, it's actually creating like a little layer around the heart that is providing like a, it's almost like adding to that callus of the heart that's kind of shutting us off a little bit. And so I think I avoid criticizing other people by just reminding myself that I don't want to feel the way I feel when I criticize other people. Now, of course, there are things, especially as you're talking about like in leadership or management, where you do need to point something out. But I think it's a great question to ask, like, where am I coming from? Is this making my heart softer or is it tightening up my heart a little bit? Am I coming at this with a charge and a sense of righteousness, like I'm gonna stick it to them? Or coming at it from place of like, again, like that place of like, do I genuinely love and want the welfare of this person? Like, do I want this person to succeed and do well? And do I feel that this criticism is gonna benefit them? And not even a criticism, but like this feedback. And also, if we turn criticism into feedback, feedback is something that needs to be invited. So am I just criticizing somebody behind their back for the sake of doing it? Like, what good is that doing? You know, behind criticism, there is an inherent sense of superiority that makes me feel like, again, I'm above you because I'm going to criticize you because you've got things that are wrong that I don't have wrong about myself and I'm going to talk about it. So if I'm just criticizing somebody behind my back, I'm just inflating my own ego and contracting the lotus of my own heart. And if I'm going to criticize somebody to their face, I should do it in a mood of feedback, and it should be invited. Like, hey, I wanted to share something with you. Like, is this a good time? Am I in the right space to share it? Are they
am
in
the right
space?
Person? Is it truthful?
Am I the right person? Does it need to be said? Does it need to be said by me? Does it need to be said by me right now?
Right.
You know? And so I think that those are the things that in terms of criticizing other people. And then in terms of receiving criticism, there's a couple of things. One is that I think it's really important for us to determine whose opinion really matters in my life. And I think that that's something that we lose sight of in social media, where anybody with an email account is able to now have a valid opinion in my life. Like, do I really care what like SurferDude278BB said about my picture that I posted or whatever? But somehow, you know, every like, every comment is treated equally. And it's really not the case that there are people in my life whose opinion that I've determined are valuable for a certain reason, because I value their character, I value their life example, and those are the people that I look towards. And if there are people in my life that their opinion, to be honest, doesn't really matter in my life because they don't share my values. They're not somebody who I believe has my best interest in mind. And if I'm humble enough and strong enough, maybe I'll take the next step and say, okay, well, what truth is there that I can learn to grow from?
The pinch of salt,
like to grow from. And so it's like you can always learn something from a criticism of like, is there truth in which I need to grow? That's a tall order.
Massive
order. But I think there's also a sense of just like we do ourselves a huge favor by just like sifting out like whose opinions really matter in my life and whose don't. And I think we get really confused when we just think that anybody says carries equal weight in my life. People inherently share equal value as spirit souls, but in terms of the influence in which I let people have in my life, I need to be very careful how I dish out that percentage.
I think most of the time we're so unconscious about it as well. Like, something that I'm noticing more and more is how, because I don't journal, and I mean, I used to, and more recently because of just sheer busyness, I find it difficult to find the time. And that's just an excuse, if I'm honest. But I think that the majority of my kind of learnings get brushed under the guise of being busy. And I think that there's so much that's coming my way, even in this conversation. Like, you would think that this conversation's about Dayal giving to whoever's listening to this podcast, but if I'm honest, I'm sat here feeling like I'm learning something and I don't want to forget it. So this is valuable that it's being recorded. It's being, you know, but I think a lot of the lessons that we go through on a daily basis in almost every conversation could be noted as learning points. And it's not that we the next day automatically become like the perfect version of those lessons, but if there's progress, that's still success. And I think that that's something that I'm starting to learn more and more, which is what can be my small, minuscule but achievable step that I can take tomorrow that's going to make me a little more XYZ. You know, instead of trying to think what can be my next step to do or to achieve monetary success, what can I do to take a small step to be more XYZ?
Yeah, totally. And I think that when we look at criticism, you know, Richard Rohr makes this beautiful point. He's an author that I love. He mentions that the true self never really gets offended. It's just too big. It's too broad. It's too deep in itself. And that it's always the ego that's getting rubbed the wrong way. And so when somebody's criticizing me and it hurts, it's like, what false conception about myself is being poked at right now?
Wow.
I have a conception. I'm a great listener. I'm a great podcaster. I'm funny. I'm smart. I'm a great kirtan singer. I'm a great whatever. I'm a great leader. I'm a great husband. I'm a great wife. I'm a great mom. I'm a great teacher. I'm a great son. I'm a great whatever. We have these conceptions about ourselves. And a criticism is just a big, giant poke in that conception. And it's the false ego cracking because it's like, oh, I wasn't ready to learn or to see the ways in which I'm not God's gift to everyone I meet. And so I think that what happens is criticism, when if I'm able to like take that step back, it's like my real self is completely secure. But all these ego, I spent so much time building up a conception about myself that I want other people to see. I write a story about my life and I'm like a script writer that's like running around trying to get people to buy the script of my life and purchase the movie of my life and buy into it. And a criticism just kind of like pokes at that.
It deflates it.
And that's, I think, why it hurts so much. And so if I focus so much on the criticism, then it really hurts. But if I like let go of the ego narrative that I have, it becomes a lot easier to take and it's not as personal.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read something like that in the Bhagavatam, which is like the postgraduate study of Bhakti Yoga. And I've shared this before on another podcast, but I think it's apt in this conversation where it's written that if we own our faults, and if we own just being completely honest about who we are beyond all of the coverings, if we're completely honest about who we are and knowing our coverings, then when someone calls out those coverings, it hurts way less.
Yeah.
It hurts way, way less. And we can tell how attached we are to the covering by how much we get hurt almost.
Yeah, you definitely. And I think it's great at looking at like what's getting hurt.
Yeah, what's getting hurt,
you
right?
Know, what part of me is getting hurt and what part of my story is cracking right now? And so I think it's a great lesson, and I think that it becomes, I think also when we're able to approach life in a much greater mood of curiosity, like, oh, how can I use this opportunity just to learn something about myself? And so I appreciate it. That's beautiful. I love that.
This has been great. Can we do this forever?
I'm here. I live in New York. You got to move to New York.
Oh, I'm not doing that. I'm staying in London. I'm firm-footed in London. Quick fire questions. You want to go into some of those?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay. Something you're curious about right now?
Something I'm curious about right now is what does God have in store for me in the next phase of my life? I'm just being in the lookout for that. I'm just really curious.
What does God have in store for me? How do you... See, I suck at this quick fire round, people. I'm so sorry. I'm always interested in the follow up.
No, me. How do you? I'm not the quick. Curious should be something about. I'm curious about the next Marvel movie or something, and I'm like, I want to know what are my blockages to love. I'm like, okay,
it's not
a quick question.
It's so deep and meaningful. How can you do it in one sentence? How do you see? Like, what do you mean by see what God is teaching? Like, how do you even see those lessons?
I guess like I look at where I'm at right now. I'm 38 years old, and like I said, I became a monk when I was 18, and leading up to that, I had all kinds of questions about life and where my life would end up.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'm learning about myself along the way, and the ego layers are getting cracked as I try to, progress in my spiritual life. And there's an ideal of where I want to get to in life, and I guess there's blind spots. I think part of the criticism that hurts is because it's exposing blind spots about ourselves. And so it's as painful as it is, I'm curious to know about myself, like, what are those blind spots that I'm not seeing, that like I say I want to love people, but then I interact in a way that's unloving and is ego driven and is kind of like twisted in a way that like feels unsettling. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, what is it about me that I need to see, and how do I work through it in a way that I can get to that place? And it's not because it's not like this self-flagellate, like, I'm not loving, I need to be more loving. It's because I want to experience life from that place. I don't want to experience life from the platform of my ego and competition and resentment and grudges and like feeling you owe me something. Like, I genuinely want to be in that place where I can just, even if someone's criticizing me, I just feel love in their heart because I'm able to see something from a deeper place. And so I'm just kind of like, wow. Like, and you know, you find this in intimate relationships, you know, like my wife will say, like, you don't recognize how you're so this way or that way, you know, when we're getting an argument or something like that. And so, because they're the perfect mirror, you know, that show up, you know, the way that you don't see about yourself. So I'm just really curious, like, what are the things I'm not seeing about myself that are blockages to love?
God bless you, Dale. May God bless you. Because in God blessing you to be able to see that, maybe you can teach me how to see my blockages. So many of them.
Yeah.
What's something you're personally working through at the moment?
How to love people.
You're just all about love. In short, what legacy would you like to leave behind in this world?
A legacy I would like to leave behind.
If you say love, goddammit.
A legacy I'd like to leave behind is that I want people to know that they're never alone. I think that's something that's also a big mission of mine, because you were talking about earlier the idea of like sometimes feeling unlovable or feeling not loving.
Yeah.
And we just kind of like cower away under the bed sheets thinking that we're all on our own. And I think that no matter what we're going through, no matter what people see or don't see about us, I think what we're looking for more than anything is just to be less alone in our struggles. And I think it's very rarely the struggle itself that we're dealing with. It's the feeling of being alone in that struggle, that nobody knows what I'm going through. Nobody knows how to help me. People are going to reject me if they really know and understand. And I think that sometimes nothing in our life can change, nothing about our challenges, our struggles, our mental health, our emotional health, our relationship crises, or whatever it might be, or moral failings, or whatever is going on. I think that when we know that we're not alone, like somebody sees us, and I think that that's what we're yearning for more than anything. And so I think the legacy that I want and hope to leave behind is that people feel less alone in their journey.
Wow, flipping heck, that's deep. What a legacy. Again,
I don't know how I'm gonna. I don't know how I'm gonna do it.
I mean, you're doing it right now.
I'm starting on this podcast. Hoping that.
I mean, let's be completely honest. You are doing it right now. I mean, the Bhakti Center is exactly that. Like, just being someone that's at the forefront of a place, a community that opens its doors to anyone and everyone, that creates a space for people to explore their spirituality. That's exactly the legacy. So I mean, just keep going, man. I think it's flipping amazing.
Thank you.
I have full respect for everything you're doing, just based on, you know, the way that not only are you doing it in a way which is, in my opinion, you're walking the talk, you're showing the way, you're going the way. And I think that that's something that we need more of in this world.
Thank you.
We need more people that walk their talk. mean what they say. So
I'm going to come on your podcast more often just so you can get your encouragement.
Bro, just do it. I'm 100%. I'll fly to New York again just for
I'll
this.
I'll go to London. I want to come to London this summer. I've been to London twice last year, but it was like on work stuff and film and stuff. I just got to come and just hang out.
Just come and hang out. All right, let's spend some time together. Done. If we make it happen, by the way, if Doyle comes to London, how many of you would like to see him come and do an event or come and do something where it's community building, maybe a speaking, facilitating him speaking more? If you do, then just drop a comment down below and just stir it up a little bit, people.
Stir it up.
Something you used to deeply value, but don't value as much anymore.
Something that I used to deeply value, but don't value as much anymore. Oof. Something that I deeply value that I don't deeply value as much anymore. Being invited to everything.
Holy crap. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still working on that one. Yeah. I have a lot of FOMO in my life.
It's called JOMO. Have you heard of JOMO?
The joy of missing out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I think it's correlating with also my need and desire to try to go to bed earlier. And so I just think that there's less of a need and valuing of like being invited and included in everything. It's still something I'm working on a lot, but that's something that is trying to be in a transition phase towards.
I mean not at all that is prescriptive, but just something that's really helped me is exhausting myself in the point where I get my kicks in other ways.
Yeah.
Like I think we spoke about it during this podcast where we spoke about how like if you're fulfilled then there's no need to look for validation elsewhere. I mean there was something around that topic, and I think it's the same thing in the JOMO thing where I used to really feel it, but then when I had kids, and for me it was that fact that having a loving connection at home meant that I felt totally fulfilled, that if someone didn't invite me to stuff I was so fine with it. And in fact now I'm like, people ask me all the time like, oh, how come you're not hanging out till like 1 a.m. Like, because I got my kicks elsewhere, you know? I'm fulfilled elsewhere.
I want to be invited and then decline the invitation.
Hell yeah.
And stay home, but just know at least that I was invited.
All right, okay. I don't know about that. I don't know how to deal with that.
It's like, that's a whole other mess up. It's a whole other thing you got to work out.
Yeah. It goes back to childhood somehow.
It goes back to my childhood trauma.
I heard Americans love talking about childhood traumas. Is that a thing?
We do or don't?
You do.
We do? Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a big thing.
Oh, okay.
It's a big, yeah.
The Brits just don't do it.
They don't do it?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If you could create one law that everyone has to follow, what would it be?
Be honest.
Just be honest.
Just be honest.
Yeah. What does lying get you?
Yeah, I think that that's just as simple as it would be. I think if people just were honest more often, we'd be in a better place.
Doyle.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my brother.
Appreciate it. Love you tons. Appreciate
you. So much.
You're doing great, great work. Please keep up what you're doing. Please come visit New York more often. I want to come see you in London.
Let's
and
do it.
Just thank you for what you're doing. You're doing such amazing. It's not easy. It's not easy to not only want to make a difference in the world, but then actually get up off of the couch or wherever you're sitting and do something and mobilize people in a team. And I see you doing that day in and day out. And it's really exemplary. And I just want to encourage you and to say that you are making an impact and a difference, and I'm seeing it from across the pond here in New York, and I appreciate you a lot, and I send you all the love and encouragement, and I want to just keep seeing you rise and shine because it's really beautiful. You're doing a great job.
I appreciate it, and right back at you, I see the pain of the discipline that you're going through. It's uncomfortable, you're having to go through so many things to try and serve people, and but the pain of regret of not doing it, and I think it sits for both of us, that the pain of regret of not having tried to share, to try and create communities of love, to try and spread spiritual joy, that pain would be much more, let's call it, unbearable.
Totally.
So I think that, yes, it's definitely intense. I think both of our lives are intensely driven by so many other things, so many engagements, so many opportunities. But I think the pain of regret of not having tried, I think sits with me as unbearable. And so, I'm happy.
Thank you.
I'm so happy we did this. Thank you to each and every one of you also for being here, for listening, for learning with us, for I hope there was a moment there for you, if not five, of deep kind of connection moments where you maybe need to rewind the tape. And do we call it rewind the tape?
You can. It's an expression these days. It used to be a literal term. Now it's an expression.
Rewind the digital YouTube thingy and then re-listen to it, because this is not just a single moment of entertainment, but hopefully there's moments of deep transformation there for you, something that maybe you need to work through, something that you need to share with another person. You know, if you heard something that was powerful, share it with someone else today. That would be really amazing. That would really make me happy, actually, to hear that you're sharing wisdom that you're hearing on this podcast forward. I can't wait to see you on the next episode of For Soul's Sake. And let me know, by the way, who you want to hear on this podcast. I'd love to hear your suggestions of people that, you know, you think would have a good, honest conversation on spirituality. This has been For Soul's Sake. See you on the next episode. Namaste. For soul's sake.